powerful experience with the Lord when they first came to faith, it would be easy for someone like that to then later on doubt that experience. But if you have, instead of two or three main reasons you believe in God, you have 25 or 30 or 38 or however many there are, then doubt, it's a lot harder to doubt. You can download the list. We'll post again at the end of the talk where that is. And there's also a list of resources that you can read if you want to read on it. All of these are not arguments for Christian theism. Some of them are. Some of them are arguments for a generic God. Some are just arguments that are the defeater for, say, naturalism. Many are very compelling. Some are just signposts, but taken all together, we hope you'll be impressed with their comprehensiveness. And the point we're going to make at the end is, it's really a separate argument saying, look, there's all of these compelling arguments. Taken all together, that's an argument for the existence of God. You're going to find some of these convincing and some of them not so much, because that's the way everybody is. Everybody's different. But all of the ones that we're covering are ones that have already been convincing to many people. So you may find one type of reasoning convincing. I may find another type of reasoning convincing because you're wrong. But everybody's different. So
I'm differently wrong when I'm wrong.
When you disagree with me, you're wrong. Yeah. Okay. Now, I know you're getting old and we're going to have to really move fast here. So, you know, do you need a little oxygen before we get started?
No, I took all the oxygen I can get at one time already.
Okay, good.
And I'm trying to kill me with that.
All right. Mark, you want to take the first one?
Sure. Let me set up the share screen, though, because we can look at some of these arguments as we're going along.
Yes.
So let's see if this works. Okay, so for some, hang on a second, folks. I'm trying to figure this out.
See what I mean?
It's because of that excess oxygen you gave you. Okay, are we getting a shared screen here?
That's good enough.
All right, well, let's start with these two. The first one is the philosophical argument known as the ontological argument. The reason that we put this in here is because it shows up so often. In my opinion, as a philosopher, I think it's probably one of the weakest. And the ontological argument goes something like this, that there is something, some entity greater than which cannot be conceived. And that entity we will call God. And sometimes the arguments on that are so nuanced, and the arguments against it are so nuanced, that you end up getting into kind of this philosophical quagmire. And as I've looked these things over for the past 15 years, there are ontological argument variants that are very persuasive and ontological argument variants that are not. So I just wanted you to know what it is. An ontological argument is the argument that greater than which there is nothing that can be conceived, and that entity is God. And the earliest variant of that one, I think, is St. Anselm's, although don't quote me on that, there may be an earlier one than that. And that goes along something like this: greater than which there is nothing that can be conceived, even if you don't believe in God, but you can conceive that there is a God. And so that the argument goes that if you can conceive the God, and that God actually, you can conceive that the God exists, then the existing God would be greater than non-existing God. Therefore, God exists. Now, if that seems like a play on words or some philosophical nonsense, a lot of other people think of that too. But it's a very serious argument, and it's been worked over for about two millennia. So just know that the ontological argument is out there. It is one among many, and don't try to get too wrapped up in it unless you want to play some serious philosophy. So argument number two is the cosmological argument. That too is a philosophical argument. It does not rely on any evidence. And we're going to distinguish this from another argument later on when we talk about the origin of the universe. But the cosmological argument basically says that every effect has a cause. And so everything that exists is an effect or a cause. And if every effect has a cause, and everything that we know is contingent on some other cause, then there must have been a first cause that is uncaused. And the universe, therefore, must be caused by something that is not itself caused. And the thing that is not itself caused is what we will call God. This is also a very well-treaded argument, although this one, I believe, and so do most scholars, has far more power and is much easier to sustain and much easier to defend than the ontological argument. It's also wonderful in the fact that it's intuitive. It's not hard for people to say, okay, something must have started this universe. What did it? The only problem you're going to have is you're going to run into people who are going to say, well, who caused God? That isn't necessarily such a big problem because it allows you then to start talking about the properties of God, such that God is not caused, that he's self-sufficient, omnipotent, etc., and all these other different features, which we won't get into right now. But the bottom line is that the cosmological argument is intuitive, very easy to defend. It's been around for a long time, and the so-called rebuttals against it aren't all that great. So it's actually a very good argument for a philosophical argument.
Great. Number three.
Antinaturalism. Oh, okay, so we got to do this.
There we go.
I have to stop the screen sharing every time I do this.
Who set that up?
I don't know. I don't know how this works. Well, why don't you just go ahead with it and I'll pop it up.
You know, the next one is near-death experiences. I am really excited about this one because I find it to be really easy to understand and extremely compelling. There's two types of near-death experiences. Number one is when someone is almost dead, often with no brain waves, no heartbeat, and they will see things like lights or loved ones from their past. Those can be explained away by just, you know, dreams or visions or something that the brain is making up. But there's a second type, and that is where they leave their body, say they're on an operating table, and they float up into the area above the operating room, and they see things and remember things that they could not have seen even if had they been on the operating table fully awake. If you want to know more about this, look up Gary Habermas. He's got a bunch of really good YouTube videos, and he's actually the editor of a peer-reviewed journal that talks about near-death experiences. And he's got two really good ones that I want to give as an example. There's one woman who had OCD, and she's on the operating table.
What do you mean OCD?
Obsessive compulsive disorder.
Okay, thank you.
She's on the operating table. She's starting to die, no brain waves, no heartbeat. As she perceives it, she comes out of her body, so her center of consciousness is no longer on the table. She is up inside the room, and she notices on top of one of the large pieces of equipment that was in the operating table, a piece of equipment that was taller than like a refrigerator, mm-hmm. one of those identification plaques that hospitals put on everything. And it was a 12-digit number. And she said, as she remembers, as she's floating around, she said, well, I have OCD, and what do I do when I see a large number? I try to memorize. That's just her obsessive compulsive behavior. She memorized the 12-digit number. The doctors were able to revive her. her center of consciousness went back into her body. She recounted later on that to a nurse that this happened, and she was able to correctly tell the nurse the 12-digit number that was on top of the piece of equipment in the operating room that she couldn't have seen even if she was awake and looking because it was so tall. Mm-hmm. The second one is even more remarkable. There have been several where there are people who are blind at birth and they have a near-death experience where they can see during the near-death experience. And then when they are revived, they are again blind. So the near-death experience is the only time in their life they've been able to see. Now, here's what's remarkable about this. If you think about it, it seems to be a piece of evidence for two different things. Number one, that our consciousness is not entirely physical. Number two, the fact that they remember the experience means that our memory is not entirely physical. Where did that, where was their memory being stored of their experience of reading the number between the time they read it and the time they went back into their body? Yet when they were in their body, she was able to recall this experience. Now, it seems to me, I don't know how else to interpret this, and I don't want to say it's a slam dunk because nothing in science is, but this alone seems to be, to me, to be a defeater for naturalism. Even if it only happened one time in all of human history, but it's happened hundreds of times, those kinds of experiences. Yeah. Number four, our rational, if evolution is true, our rational faculties cannot be trusted. And here's what we mean by this. Alvin Plantinga has a huge argument based on this. So if you like this, go check him out. But it basically goes like this. If we have a characteristic that gives us no evolutionary advantage, why should we trust it? There's a couple. Think about the ability to do higher math. They say that the earliest man, Homo sapiens sapiens, still had the ability to do calculus. Now, is there any evolutionary advantage to having that extra circuit in our brain that allows us to do calculus? How could evolution, why would it have produced that?
Now, is that Plantinga's argument?
That's part of Plantinga's argument. Okay. It's much more robust and better and deeper than what I can do here.
Okay.
Another is the ability to think abstractly. It seems that if evolution were true, it would only waste its energy on characteristics in us that help us reproduce more robustly. But I think that the fact that there's all of these things in us, and we're going to be getting into a lot of those later on, there's all these things in us that don't seem to have any evolutionary advantage. They're better explained by the Christian model, which is that we are created in God's image and he gave us this ability to do these kinds of things.
Well, let's talk about that one for just a second, because our rational faculties can't be trusted. One of the problems seems like, well, there's two problems. First, the evolutionary one. Mm-hmm. If I were an evolutionist, I would say, okay, as evolution progresses, it naturally will have times where it's a particular species or any number of species will be inefficient. That's how they eventually get culled. Mm-hmm. They don't, a particular function isn't necessary anymore, and it's naturally, quote, naturally selected out. Mm-hmm. So it's not a big deal that we have these particular faculties that aren't necessarily produced to advance evolution, but we just happen to get them anyway. It's something called the neutral theory of evolution, mm-hmm. where there's all sorts of stuff that happens that doesn't necessarily produce any kind of valuable progress. So if I were an evolutionist, I'd say, yeah, so what about that? If I were a Christian, I'd come back and I'd say, well, listen, if your faculties are entirely dependent on this chemical substance in your head, why should your chemical substances be right and mine be wrong? That's why our faculties are unreliable, because they're deterministic.
Right. That's right.
So that doesn't even make any sense to our faculties are trustworthy when they're all entirely naturalistic.
That's right. That's right. What are the chances that you can independently determine what 2 + 2 is and I can independently determine it if our faculties were created by a blind process that whose goal isn't to produce a calculator in our head? Its goal is to make us work more robust in reproducing. The model that I have in my head, it's kind of like when the creators of Windows 7 wanted to upgrade Windows 7 to, what was the next one,
eight.
Windows 8?
Yes, that's 8 comes after 7.
Imagine trying to modify, thank you, Mark, I wasn't sure of that. Imagine trying to modify a computer program by any kind of blind, natural, or random process. Just go to the code and get rid of a bunch and add some more and see what happens. Well, it's going to be garbage. It won't work. And there's certain lines of code that have to be modified. Some will probably be deleted. Others are very carefully changed or added. And it seems to me it's exactly the same issue when we're talking about going from one species to another or one phyla to another, and we're going to get to that. There are very specific things that have to be rewritten and added to go from one phyla to another, one species to another, and it is like a computer program that has to be done so precisely that there's not enough time in the history of the universe for a random, unguided process to be able to do that. So it's really unlikely that some random process is not only going to give us this ability to think rationally, but then, oh my goodness, all of a sudden we've got this whole other ability in our head. We've got this built-in calculator where we can do math. It would be like, again, the creators of Windows 7 modifying it to Windows 8, and unbeknownst to them, there's this perfectly intact other program that just happens to function perfectly, that's just a side product of what they did. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, we could get into that much more deeply, and the good thing is we don't have to.
Yeah, that's right.
Because we really are trying to get through a survey. And the point of this whole session is to get through all of them and then realize that the cumulative case is what matters.
So that's right.
In the case of our rational faculties not being trusted, we can argue that either way. But the point is that if our rational faculties can be trusted, is that more consistent with a theistic view or a naturalistic
view? That's right. Thank you, sir. Go for this one, Mark.
Okay. Earlier in number 2, we had the philosophical argument for the cosmological argument. That was entirely a philosophical argument. It was almost, it was an analytic argument. You don't require any kind of empiricism in order to prove it. But in number 5, the origin of the universe, which begins our whole series on origins, the question then goes from merely being an analytic argument about causes and effects to the evidence for the origin of our particular universe. So this argument is an empirical argument, and the argument goes something like this, that with the scientific knowledge that we have to date, and have had for about 25 years, and the continuing knowledge that we're acquiring, as it appears to be heading in the same direction, that the universe had a beginning, that there was a point before which there was no space, time, matter, or energy. And the question then is, if you don't know what happened before that, and we can't tell because that we don't have any mechanical devices or instruments that can get that far back, create the energy and do the experiments to infer them, then the question is it more likely that a God that is consistent with or identical with the God of the Bible created the universe, or that the universe came from some unknown source? And if it does come from some unknown source, you're still going to get stuck with a cosmological argument. Somewhere along the road, you're going to have a beginner, a creator. So the origin of the universe argument from empiricism is that we have evidence that the universe did start. And that, along with other evidence, tells us that the God of the universe is a more likely explanation or a much more powerful explanation than that nature itself without a God did it.
Thank you. The easiest way to argue that I find is that whatever the source of the universe was, it has to be outside the universe.
Yes.
Science tells us that both matter and time came into existence at the beginning of the universe. So if that's true, there was nothing, not a quantum foam, but nothing. If there's nothing, then there's no potential for anything. And if there's no potential for anything, then nothing can come from it in a naturalistic sense.
Right.
So what created this universe that's not only here, but orderly and structured and follows physical laws and has the ability, you know, 10 billion years after it's created, for life, to support life? That looks more like design than it looks like any kind of natural or random process.
It does. And another important thing to remember, as we're getting through this really fast, is that once you start talking about the origin of the universe, and you bump into the empirical boundaries of science, and that means we don't have any other evidence, that once you're boxed into the universe, claiming that there is a multiverse or something like that, you're not talking science anymore. You've just moved from science to metaphysics. And that's an important thing to remember, because it's by definition metaphysics, because it's beyond any of the laws of physics. So the origin of the universe is empirical, and to go beyond it right now is metaphysics. And if you want to get into metaphysics, thank you. That's the argument and the discussion I really want to have with you, Mr. Non-Christian.
That's right. Very good. Next one, origin of life. This is a killer as well. This one's big. Think about what we know about first life. The first life on Earth looks very much like a present-day bacteria. Similar complexity. A bacteria cell, Mark, is more complex than any human-made thing. A.J. Roberts likes to equate it to a city. It has factories, it has waste management, it has transportation systems, it has energy systems, it has information systems with error correction. It can reproduce itself. Imagine taking a city the size of Los Angeles and shrinking it to the size of a bacteria. Okay, it wouldn't be any more complex than a bacteria. Naturalists tell us that somehow all happened without any guidance. A bacteria, Mark, has a billion chemical reactions going on per second. And naturalists will tell us that, well, we know how a couple of amino acids are formed, and we know a couple other things, some basic sugars. So we're on our way. We're almost there. But the truth is, we don't even know how many pieces it would take to build a bacteria. When I asked A.J. Roberts, she said it would be in the high hundreds of thousands or even millions. And we've got three or four, and they're telling us we're on our way. So I've got this analogy. The world record for the long jump is 29 and a half feet. Okay? I looked it up last night. Now imagine somebody comes to you and says, or comes to the world and they say, I'm really good at it. I'm the guy that holds the world's record. What I'm going to do is eventually I am going to long jump over the Grand Canyon. Now the Grand Canyon at its widest point is 10 miles wide. Okay? And you look at him like he's insane. And you say, the Grand Canyon is 10 miles wide. And he said, well, look, I've got these new nutrients, you know, this new stuff, and that's going to add at least 3 inches. And I figured out a way to lose some weight. That's a couple or 3 inches more right there. And then they have these new muscle vitamins, and I'm going to get 5 or 6 inches out of there. So I have every confidence that eventually I'm going to be able to jump that 10 miles. That's how ridiculous this argument is. They don't tell us. They tell us the two or three things that they've discovered, but they don't tell us about the huge gap between where we are and ever being able to say that we have a naturalistic way of explaining it. And it gets worse, because every year we're discovering more and more function that the cell has, which means for every time he adds 3 inches to jumping the Grand Canyon, there's an earthquake and the chasm gets a quarter of a mile wider.
It's So I don't quite buy that analogy. And the reason that I don't is not that it doesn't have any truth to it, but that there's a flaw in it. And if I were the naturalist looking at that, I would say, okay, I get what you're saying. The leap from non-life to life is a pretty big one, and we haven't figured it out yet. So your Grand Canyon, I'm not quite so sure I buy that. It's more like the long jumper has to figure out how to go from 20 feet to 25 feet. Or if we want to get even more interesting, we can say that the difference between science and the long jumper is that the long jumper, we know physically, will never be able to make it across there. So there's a presumption built into your analogy, and that is that it's impossible. And so that presumption, I think, is where the analogy fails, because it's presuming the very thing you're trying to prove. So I would say for some people that makes sense because it lets them see how far it is, but it's also an exaggeration. And in some cases, it's presumptive.
Fair enough. And no analogies are perfect. And I wanted to use that analogy because it does show how large the gap is of where we would have to go that nobody likes to talk about. But I have another analogy, and maybe you'll like this one better.
Okay.
Imagine there's a lightning strike in an oil field. Okay. And it hits the oil that's oozing out of a hole in the ground. Some scientist walking along discovers there's this little piece of natural rubber that occurred from the lightning strike hitting the oil. And he says, wow, now we can imagine how a whole automobile tire could have come about from a naturalistic scenario. And if we can create the tire, then we can create the whole automobile.
I think that's probably a little closer to the problem, because the problem is we don't know how one step goes to the next or how many steps there are.
Right.
So I think that second analogy is stronger. And I think it also serves the same purpose, though, is it helps people understand just how far away we are and how scientifically untenable that is right now.
Very good. Thank you. And if anybody's interested, look up James Tour, T-O-U-R. He's got a million good YouTube videos. He's a very eminent scientist, and he talks about how impossible, not impossible, but we aren't anywhere near close to figuring this out from a naturalistic standpoint. Next one, Mark, origin of phyla. You want to start on this one?
Yeah, let's talk about that. The phyla are the next order down from the kingdom. In other words, the very top of the chain of all creatures is the kingdom, and then the phyla, and then so forth on the way down. So the thing that we have going for us when we're dealing with evolutionists particularly is that about 560, 580 million years ago, you have this sudden burst, this huge addition of fundamental body plans to the creatures on Earth that are completely inexplicable. They're inexplicable naturalistically because they occurred so quickly and they're so radical. We're talking about the difference between a sponge and a human. That huge of a occurring in just a few tens of millions of years. And all of the body plans, I don't remember how many phyla there are. There's plenty of them. But there's no way to explain that huge diversity occurring suddenly, or at least geologically suddenly. 20 million years for us is a long time, but in geological terms, it's not. So how does that happen so quickly? And it defies the rules of the molecular clocks that we know change within species. So that's a very powerful argument, because you go from single-cell creatures or collections of single-cell creatures to multicellular creatures with backbones and gills and teeth and all sorts of different things, that all of the body plans that we see on Earth today, and some that aren't on Earth today, some that have already died off. So the origin of the phyla argument is the argument that it makes more sense, especially given the biblical verses regarding the creation that God creates and then kills off, that God was the one who created these phyla, these very different creatures in this very short period of time. And as Hugh Ross has talked about many times, there are reasons why he did that, that without having done that, we would not have human life as we do today. So origin of the phyla is an argument that basically says God did it, and it makes more sense that God did it than it does that it was just naturalistically done, because we have no way of showing that it could be done naturalistically.
You know, the fossil record, Mark, is actually really bad evidence for evolution, because all you see is these giant leaps from one thing to the other. It's pretty interesting. So if people are interested in this, I have two references: Evolution, A Theory in Crisis by Michael Denton. It's an older book, but it's still very applicable. And then Darwin's Doubt by Stephen Myers, a giant 550-page tome, which is absolutely riveting. Number eight, Origin of Humans. You want to do that one? Go on that one, Mark?
The origin of the humans is akin to the argument for the origin of phyla. And that is, you have a huge leap between humans and what are supposedly the precursors to humans. Now, Hugh has gone into this in great detail. I won't go into it in great detail. But the bottom line is that we are fundamentally different from any of the apes or any of the simians or any of the so-called humanoids that are supposedly our precursors. So all the versions of the different hominids have something so different from us, or we're so different from them, that we can say that we are a unique creation. For example, our ability to reason, our ability to create art, and our ability to do a lot of other things that we're going to discuss in a few minutes, separate us from any other creature. And this occurs suddenly. There is absolutely zero evidence that any creature that supposedly came before us was just a slight distance away from us. So this argument, the origin of humanity, is a very powerful argument in that respect. And the best thing about it is there are so much corollary evidence that goes along with it from other disciplines other than just, say, for example, biochemistry.
Very good. Origin of symbolic language.
Let me work with that one. So one of the things that makes humans unique is that we use symbolic languages. For example, when we describe a mathematical problem, we use symbols to describe those problems. When we write words, we use symbols. The whole idea of symbology is unique to humans. There is no other creature ever that has had a symbolic language. Now, symbolic language gives us evidence for something that's unique to humans that we can use as evidence. His image, does it make more sense that he would have imbued them with the ability to have symbolic language so that he could communicate with them? They could communicate. None from the scientific quarter on how symbolic language arose in humanity. There's lots of theories, or what I would call speculations. They're not really even theories because they're not testable. But they're speculations that, grunts turned into grunts coupled with an ostensive definition. You know, you point to something and you grunt at that. And that's the beginning of the symbolic language. That's rife with problems. First of all, there's no way to get the evidence that ever happened. And the second one is that our symbolic language is so complicated that there is no way to get from grunts and pointing to symbols. Symbols are a unique abstraction, and abstractions do not come from merely pointing at objects. It's a completely different function in the mind. Creating abstractions is a unique and special function. So that leads us to the number 10, which is the origin of complex oral language. So the oral language and symbolic language are similar, but they're not identical. in oral language, you could argue that, you know, you can grunt and then point to something, and that grunted sound gets recognized. And every time you hear that sound, you recognize what they're pointing to. The only problem is that that's simplistic. I don't know how many languages there are in this world. There's thousands that we're losing at the same time. But if you look at these different languages, they don't merely denote things baldly, the way pointing at a rock and saying rock points or denotes the rock. There are so many nuances, so many subtleties, that it's almost impossible to directly translate one language into another. As a matter of fact, there is no way to translate all of the words in one language to all of the words in another language. There isn't a one-to-one correspondence. There are some things that get phrased and specified in unique ways in each language, which tells us that there's something very particular about the mind of man, that humans do more with oral language than merely point to things and denote them, or even point to things and try and get people to do things. Far, far more with it. We express things like love and emotion. We express art. We express all sorts of things with oral language that doesn't get done with any other creature and can't be explained naturalistically. Would we expect God to do that? Yes, we would. Would we expect nature to do it without any evidence? No, we wouldn't.
Thank you. Next one is origin of information, and what we mean by that is biological information. The first life form that we talked about a few minutes ago, like a bacteria, has DNA in it that has nucleotide pairs that act like just like a human language. There's four symbols instead of 26. And though the genetic information in a bacteria or in any living organism has all the instructions for regulating it, controlling it, and reproducing it, a lot of other things. There can be some flaws in it, but it actually corrects itself. So in many ways, it's very much like a human language. Now, as I'm talking to you, Mark, I'm picking words, putting them into sentences, putting the sentences into paragraphs, arranging the paragraphs into thoughts so that I can convey the meaning that I'm trying to say to you. That requires a conscious mind producing the information for it to be functional. And the basic argument here is another one of those arguments that's really, really powerful. In our common experience, functional information always originates in a mind. Now, computers can write programs that contain information, but that computer was programmed by a human being that told it how to think. The original information in all the computers ever made on Earth, the original information came from a human mind. So there's enough information in the first life form to fill about a 300-page book if it was a written human language. Just like a human language, it needs to be in a particular order and can only have so many mistakes before it becomes dysfunctional. So just like a human language, information always originates in a mind. It looks like the first life on Earth that has that information in it is so much like a human book, like human information, it's much more rational to believe that it was that first life was programmed, that information came from a mind.
Also, that information in that case presumes several things. Number one, it presumes that there's a sender, and it presumes that there's a receiver.
That's right.
And that there's going to be some output. And you can't have any one of those three things without having all three of them at the same time.
That's right. It's like if I came to you with an old 8-track cassette and I said, Mark, let's play this. The music's great. Well, you don't have a player anymore for that. So the information is pointless. There's a whole system that has to be built of coding, then information, then encoding before it's functional.
Yes.
And that's another argument.
Yeah. The good thing about that is it's not terribly hard to describe that to people.
Right.
And it also opens up a lot of other options for describing what's going on there, and some of the problems that are going on.
That's right.
But we're only on number 12, so we better
get to it. A good reference on that one, John Lennox's book, God's Undertaker. All right, number 12, Origin of Consciousness. Why don't you take these next two, Mark?
Okay, the origin of consciousness and origin of mind are two of the most interesting and most difficult arguments to pose. Number one, the origin of consciousness is difficult because the definition of consciousness is so vague. It's sort of like the question of beauty or love. We all know what it is, but we don't know how to define it. Consciousness is very much the same thing. We may or may not know what consciousness is, but we certainly have yet to figure out an unequivocal way that every scientist working in the field has agreed on. So we can be very vague about that, but be careful that for any definition you come up with consciousness, someone else can argue against it. Plausibly so. So what I'll do is I'll skip the origin of consciousness and say that there is a difference between consciousness and mind, but the origin of mind is probably a stronger argument. Yeah. The reason is that it's easier to define a mind than it is to define consciousness. I don't want to escape the consciousness argument, but I will say that a simplistic definition of consciousness is the ability to perceive and to respond to the environment. And that's really simplistic, but that at least gives you an idea of the difference between a robot or something else, that a consciousness is capable of perceiving, giving meaning to that, and then responding to it, to the environment. So that means that even some things like animals and so forth have consciousness. No problem. The question is, could rocks or anything else eventually evolve into something like that? And that's where the problem of the origin of consciousness becomes an apologetic argument. Is it more likely that a conscious being would create consciousness, or an unconscious, naturalistic set of chemicals would create consciousness, on whatever definition of consciousness you want to come up with? So let's go into the definition of mind, or the origin of of mind. I distinguish mind from consciousness in that mind is what provides us with a set of emotions. Consciousness need not have emotions. Emotions, memory, self-identity, the ability to generate notions of the eternal future and the eternal past. Those kinds of things like love, will, all of those things are part of the mind. I've heard one definition of the mind as being the entity that holds subjective experiences that are completely inaccessible to the public. So if you have the experience of pain, or you have the experience of love, no one else can feel that particular experience. They may feel love under the same conditions, but they're not feeling your love. They're not feeling your pain. You have a unique mind with unique experiences that are not publicly available. So I'll use that as a definition of mind. That too is simplistic and incomplete, but we don't have time to get into too much depth of that. Maybe some other time. Mm-hmm. So what do we do? How do we use that as an apologetic argument? Well, is it more likely that a mind, that a God who has emotions and love, can evaluate things, has a sense of justice, etc., that he created humans with that mind, and that the origin of mind is in the origin of the mind of God, or that this came from just naturalistic processes for which there is zero explanation? There are a lot of speculations. There are a lot of theories. If you look at them, there are a lot of hand-waving, no evidence. So I use I think the origin of mind is a powerful argument. And when we use it and refer back to God as being the mind that originated it, it makes a lot more sense.
Thank you, Mark. You need to switch screens now. I'm going to go on with the next one, which is fine-tuning. If you listen to Hugh Ross at all, you know that there are literally hundreds of features in the physical universe. the parameters of which have to be fine-tuned to a very, very small degree for life to be able to exist. And I'm gonna make this point mostly with an analogy. Imagine I want to bake a cake. Mark, it's your birthday, and I want to bake you a cake, okay? And I put a pan in front of us, and I pour in a little bit of flour and some sugar and a handful of salt, and maybe drop a couple of eggs in there, and maybe I swirl it around a little bit, and I stick it in the oven for like a random amount of time and a random temperature, and I pull it out, I stick a candle in it, and I say happy birthday. What's that cake going to look like?
Probably like the one you really would make.
That's right, because I can't cook. It would be a complete mess. Recipes work because the quantities of the ingredients and the temperature and length of time that it's cooked are fine-tuned. They're specific. They have to be within certain parameters or you don't get what you're looking for. Now, imagine that if you use that recipe, that you're not just putting in, say, a tablespoon of sugar, but it's so finely tuned that you actually have to have a pair of tweezers and you're counting the grains of sugar. And if you're one grain off, it ruins the recipe. And then imagine that there's not just five or six ingredients in this cake, there's hundreds of ingredients, and each one has to be selected with a pair of tweezers. That's the level of fine-tuning that we're looking at for the for all kinds of features in the universe, in galaxy clusters, in galaxies, in our solar system, in planets in general, and our Earth. Every level we look at, there's levels of fine-tuning as tight as that cake analogy. If the universe came from nothing with no plan or purpose, it almost certainly wouldn't reflect that much fine-tuning. It more resembles purposeful design. Want to read more about that? Hugh Ross, Creator in the Cosmos. Next. Why don't you do 16 and 17, Mark?
Okay, from irreducible complexity?
I mean 15 and 16, yeah.
Okay, intelligent design. You know what, I'd like you to take the intelligent design because you've studied that a lot more
okay.
than I have.
Yeah. All right. Intelligent design is the idea that the features that we see in the universe, but more specifically, the features that we see in life are better explained by a conscious mind making choices than any naturalistic or random process in creating it. We know what designed things look like. They have certain characteristics, and the features, especially in the biological world, look more designed by a conscious mind, not designed by a mindless process. There's not enough time for that to happen. And I think that for me, that works not only with the origin of life, but again, every time we switch phyla, every time there's a knee created or an eyeball or a nerve ending, those are all things that have to be very specifically and carefully made and can't be built one small step at a time. It's a whole cloth invention that is added into the biological world. It seems that the best explanation for that is a conscious mind that's smart enough and powerful enough to make those choices, to do those things, rather than any mindless random process.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so the next one is number 16, which is the argument from irreducible complexity. This is a controversial one. I've been reading about irreducible complexity and the arguments for and against it since its inception when Michael Behe produced it in his Darwin's Black Box book. It's been assailed vigorously because it's so powerful. Because if it's true, that means that there had to have been parts of creation, particularly biological creation, which came from nothing, that they were whole cloth designed in one chunk and didn't evolve. Now, the benefit of this is that there are so many pieces in our biology that appear to be irreducibly complex. In other words, there's no way that you can show how it gets there. And irreducible complexity is the argument that some things, if you take if you take a particular entity and remove any one part from that entity, the function of that entity will cease. It's like a mouse trap. If you take the mouse trap and you take the bar that closes it away from it, it won't work as a mouse trap anymore. Or if you take the base away, it won't work as a mouse trap anymore. There are examples of this. The one that is most frequently seen is the little wiggly tail on the back of so many
flagella.
Yeah, the bacterial flagellum on so many kinds of cells. Is that when you start looking at that motor that runs that you can't get that motor piecemeal without, in other words, it didn't develop piecemeal. It had to have formed completely all by itself. There's no precursor to it. The arguments against that are that there are some kinds of features of cells that look like or could have existed before that, and that one cell just borrowed it and made that happen. Now, those are some pretty wild speculative leaps, and those speculative leaps are such that they don't count as evidence. You can say, well, it's plausible. Well, you have to prove that it's plausible. It's plausible in theory in the sense that you can imagine it, but that's just a story. It's plausible when you can give some kind of biochemical distance between point A and point B, every single one of those points, then you can say that's plausible. The next thing you have to do is show that it actually occurred. But at this point, we don't even have the stepwise way that would be produced without being produced whole cloth. So the DNA is where that really starts. And the DNA is irreducibly complex, if you want to consider it that way. The information in it had to come from somewhere. It does not originate. If you remove that information or you destroy the function of the DNA, you don't have an entity anymore. So irreducible complexity is a very powerful argument, but it's also one that is very often rebutted. And if you're going to use it, make sure you know which entities you're talking about and be prepared to answer whether the objections to it are well proved. In my opinion, I have yet to see an objection against it that is well proved scientifically or philosophically.
Very good. Next screen, Mark. All right, we've got a few here about the human condition, and I'm going to try to get through these real quick. And if we can, I think we're going to make it. Power of story in literature, film, theater, and the arts. Many people have started their journey to Christ by thinking about the deepest features that are in good books and literature. Many of those features, the most compelling ones, are actually Christian. And they are in our culture and compel us because they were in the Bible in the first place. And people don't realize that. Ideas like love, redemption, forgiveness, the triumph of the underdog, happy endings. There's a really excellent book on this. Holly Ordway is the author. Her book is Apologetics and the Christian Imagination. It's the first book I read on this, and it really opened up my eyes to the whole broader picture of apologetics. She was an atheist English professor and came to Christ by reading C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and really thinking about those parts of the stories in the Lord of the Rings series and C.S. Lewis's books that moved her. And she started to think, why am I so moved when somebody sacrifices their life for someone else? And over a period of about 10 years, she realized that those are all biblical stories from Christianity. And she became a Christian through that process. Next one, love and the need for relationship. Most of what we call a good, fulfilled life involves love, relationship, and community. It seems so purposeful. Can it really be explained by an unguided evolutionary process whose real aim is just fitness for reproduction? I don't think so. It seems to me that it's better seen as a precursor or a signpost heading us to a loving creator who made us for him, the greatest resource of love. Imagine what's to come with him.
And that's an important point, is what is to come?
Yes.
The Bible, unlike naturalism, points to an end, and love is an essential element of what's to come and an essential element of the reason for why it's coming. when Jesus comes to take us home and completely changes the universe, it's being done out of love. If you go look at the naturalist viewpoint, there is nothing like that. It's just death.
That's right.
It's just entirely death. Now, that's not necessarily an argument for God, but it's an argument for the question is it more likely that we would love because there's a God who loves us, or that we love because somehow some natural functions created that?
That's right.
Which are still inexplicable. No one has yet explained that.
And think about it this way. If the goal of evolution is reproductive fitness, love stands in the way of that. Because we don't want to just go have sex with anybody we can. We got to make sure we love them first. Well, that's a block to reproductive fitness, not an aid. So it doesn't seem to me that evolution would have weeded that out a long time ago.
Right. Animals don't have to have love to reproduce.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Next one is morality. If there's no God, no outside source, no source outside ourselves for judging right from wrong, then no one can tell anyone else that killing babies or torturing people is objectively wrong. I can justify anything because in the end, it will make no difference. Animals don't have this characteristic. Christianity has a many-layered and robust sense of morality. We are created by a God who loves and cares for his creatures and wants us to do the same. And I think people fight, you see nasty bumper stickers about your conscience, but I think the conscience is built into us by God. It's almost like God talking to us directly about what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. And we go around talking about how we should reject it. No, we shouldn't reject it. If we tune our conscience to tell us the right things, then we can use it as a reliable source to guide us in what we should do.
Yes. And you know, there are so many naturalists, atheists, humanists, etc., will say you don't need to have God to have morality. And I have yet to find one that gave a good enough explanation that wasn't either circular or completely vacant. Because if you get back to, well, we're just human and that's just the way it happens. Okay, well, that didn't do anything. You didn't explain how it got there. We're just human and that's how it happens. That's irrelevant. So there's the arguments for the existence of morality, that God created it rather than, that a moral God created it rather than the rocks and the so-called evolution, makes far, far more sense. Much more credible.
It does. Number 20 is yours, Mark.
Number 20 is the argument from the human condition, justice. So there's two kinds of justice. I won't go into too much depth, but there's a difference between morality and justice. The morality will tell you, okay, something's right and something's wrong. But the question is, what do you do with that right and wrong? Are there any way that you can look in the animal realm and find anything that describes them having systems of justice? Well, no, they don't really. And our system, a substantive justice, is what do you do when something is wrong? How much punishment, for example, do you inflict on somebody for a particular crime? It's called proportionality. And so the question then is it more likely than not that a God who is just gave us the sense of justice and made it so complicated? Because he's complicated. He looks at every single individual act and weighs it according to exactly a system of justice that he has. And then there's another thing that animals don't have or suggests that God exists, and that is the procedural justice. So if you look in the Old Testament, there are ways in which you conduct a trial. There are no things like that at all in the animal realm. You know, conduct trials, or they have to have a particular process to make sure that the justice is served. And the question there is, would a God do that? Would a God say, not only you have a morality to know what's right and wrong, and there's a certain degree of proportionality that will be assigned to that, but how you find out whether that person was right or wrong, what evidence do you use, etc.? I mean, two or three witnesses was assigned back in the Old Testament. This whole system, the whole notion of justice, substantive and procedural, is something that is unique to humans and does not flow from any kind of evolutionary idea at all, but it flows beautifully from the notion of God and from his perfect justice and his ways of showing us how to bring justice on earth.
Very good. Thank you, Mark. Next one is the existence of beauty and a sense of transcendence. This is a whole category of thing that the animals don't have. From an evolutionary standpoint, it just seems, again, like love, like excess baggage. When I see beauty, also, it always goes, for me personally, with a sort of longing and sadness. I see go to the museum, see a beautiful painting, I appreciate the beauty, and at the same time, I'm wishing I need more of this in my life, or there, it's not really complete. It needs more. It's part of that wonderful thing about being human is that we love it and appreciate it, and there's a sadness that comes with the longing at the same time. Now, C.S. Lewis says, if we find ourselves with a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world. And I think that the existence of beauty is something God gave us to just really enjoy the world. Imagine he could have created us with no appreciation for beauty at all, which it seems to me is what evolution would have produced had it been true. So this seems to me to be more the design of a loving creator. And the longing part is the signpost that guides us to what's coming.
So is it the sense of beauty? In other words, the fact that we can appreciate beauty, or the existence of the things beautiful that you're talking about?
I think it takes both. We could live in a world where we could long for beauty. I could imagine a world where we would long for something beautiful and there's nothing beautiful in it. You know, imagine if we were in a nuclear war zone and all we were seeing was death and destruction. There'd still be that longing for beauty, even though there isn't anything in our particular world that has it. So I think God gave us not only an appreciation of beauty, but many beautiful things to appreciate.
Thank you.
Number 22, the need to create for artistic purposes. It's another feature of humans that makes no sense from an evolutionary standpoint and does not come to us from the animals. It's better seen as another feature which is part of our being created in God's image. He creates and gives us that ability to create also. Another really good book that I want to recommend, Cultural Apologetics by Paul Gould. And he gets into many of the same areas as Holly Ordway in her book. Next one, do you have anything you want to say about
that?
No,
keep going.
Free will. This is another one that I really love to beat up. Many atheist philosophers, scientists will tell us right now that we have no free will. But when they argue against free will, in my way of thinking, it betrays the fact that they don't even believe their own argument. By the fact that he chose to tell you that free will doesn't exist. He freely constructed in his own mind this argument and put it in a particular order so that it would be convincing to you. If he really believed it, he would have just stayed home. Because if there's no free will, then nothing we say makes any difference. But that implies a choice too. So see, free will is built in to the whole fabric of how we think about things. We can't get away from that concept. And I don't think it's a fake idea. I think it's a real idea. We make choices that influence other people. And we can choose God. We can choose not to be with God, just like the atheist professor can choose how to make a speech about how free will doesn't exist and not even realize the discrepancy there.
So that's libertarian free will. In other words, the free will to do whatever you want.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Number 24, the need for our absolute need. It's stronger than need for food is our need for hope, purpose, and destiny. All of these evolutionary explanations for human behavior, Mark, are including this one. Are made up after the fact. In other words, you can look at this feature and look at the theory of evolution, and the theory is so broad and squishy that you can try to figure out how evolution might have produced this. But it's after the fact. You can't look at evolution and predict what it's going to create. So here's an example. we look at how the animal kingdom gets more and more complex as time goes on, and we say, well, that is because the specialized features allow us to take advantage of circumstances and resources that we couldn't otherwise. Well, there's been times in the fossil record where things kind of went backwards. They got more simple. Well, we explain that by, well, it's more adaptable then to the environment. Well, which is it? Well, it's both. But they just make it up after the fact. And this is another one of those. Evolution is so broad that any change or no change, you know, some things like blue-green algae hasn't changed for 3.5 billion years. It's the same sludgy muck that was there before human beings. Well, why didn't that change? Well, we don't know why these things change. We can invent a story that sounds plausible, but we're making it up after the fact. Hope, purpose, and destiny is another with those human features best explained by the idea that we cannot find our purpose in any temporary thing inside creation, but only in the permanent, reliable thing, God.
You know, when you look at the lectures done by people who are atheists, who are naturalists, who say, well, yeah, it's true, the universe is going to die a heat death, and yes, humanity will eventually become extinct, but that doesn't mean I don't have any meaning. That doesn't mean I don't have purpose. Really?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? That means that your destiny is to be extinguished, and the destiny of every other human being is to be extinct. What does, is that something that makes you happy, that you feel good about? And then they would say, no, it doesn't really make me happy, but I can find joy in doing something now. And the question there to pose to someone who says something like that is something along the lines of this. Is it more rational to believe that the God who created a purpose for this universe, which is described in the Bible, and I'd love to explain that to you, gives you that sense of desire to be meaningful, or that something that's eventually going to just extinguish? And see what they come up with.
It's kind of like that really wonderful book, Tactics, by Greg Kochel, where he calls it the Columbo tactic. And he says a lot of times the best defense of the faith is to just put a rock in their shoe, ask a question that's going to make them think about something.
Sure.
And on this whole hope, purpose, and destiny, there's a really excellent book that refers to this. It's called The Bible.
I'll buy it.
Yeah, it's a great reference on this one. Number 25, the ability to hate, to sin, and to do evil. This is actually an evidence for God. And here's how it goes. We didn't get this from the animals. They can be violent and kill for protection and food, but they don't seem to be selfish and petty and spiteful and hateful. And we do that even when it's not in our own interest. This is actually better explained by the Christian story that says we are created by God with free will and a certain amount of capability to carry out our choices, and that we rebelled, and in our narcissism and anger and greed, use those abilities selfishly for our own ends. To me, it would be a process which should see it as a distraction from its only real purpose, namely reproductive fitness, better explained by a God that gives us curiosity to have fun with the world, to learn and explore his creation.
Sir, if God told us to have dominion over the earth, it would necessitate some curiosity. I'm going to be curious about, what do I need to do over here? What do I need to do over here? Yeah. Why this? Why that? Why her? Why him? There's all sorts of things that curiosity does that God gives us to do, demands us to do. To help other people requires curiosity.
And he wants to share the process with us. He doesn't just tell us rules to live by. He lets us explore and figure out and make mistakes. And that's really exciting. This next one, I have a really long thing written and I can't do it, but I'm just going to do one of them. This is huge. I just came onto this a few weeks ago.
It's what number?
Number 27.
Okay.
The inability for a naturalist, for an atheist, to fully live with the implications of a naturalistic worldview. He still tells his wife he loves her, even though he believes love to be just the result of random workings of atoms and molecules releasing hormones in the human brain. She'll tell her children about right and wrong, even though she believes that there is no objective ethical standard. When pressed, she would admit that her worldview would force her to admit that morality is just an illusion, that Mother Teresa is really no different than Adolf Hitler. And there's a whole list of them. If you go through every feature that we have, the appreciation of beauty, our ability to freely choose, all of those things in Numbers 18 through 26, if you really think about it, if you don't believe in a transcendent creator that made us, you cannot live out that, the implications of those.
Yeah, that worldview is untenable.
That's right. Next one is really powerful. Documented miracles. A miracle is a physical thing that goes against the laws of physics and normal day-to-day experience. This one I know absolutely is true, and I'm not going to get into the details, but I had a physical miracle happen to me when I was young, when I was 10 or 12. So that has given me confidence and evidence for physical miracles. Twice in times when I've given talks, I've asked the audience, how many, just randomly, how many of you have had an actual physical miracle happen to you? And each time it was about a third of the audience. There's a book, it's 1,100 pages long, it's two volumes, I have it at home. Craig Keener.
How do you spell the last name?
K-E-E-N-E-R. And it's called Miracles. And he spends much of the book defending miracles, that miracles could happen from a philosophical standpoint, but the most compelling part of the book is just documented miracles, one after the other, after the other. And there's one real quickly that I'll bring. Woman brings her 10-year-old son into the doctor. The son has a club foot from birth. Doctor is not a believer. While they're doing an examination of the club foot, the woman prays for the child. The club foot opens up and becomes normal in front of the unbelieving doctor, and he documents it. Do not discount this one. Number 29, fulfilled prophecy. I read an article by Hugh Ross online. He says that there's about 2,500 prophecies in the Bible. 2,000 of them have been fulfilled. There's a couple really good examples. Daniel, before 500 BC, predicted Christ's ministry, when it would happen to the year. Approximately 700 BC, Micah, the prophet, the Old Testament prophet, named Bethlehem as the birthplace of the coming Messiah. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these. Gosh, Mark, we might make it. Number 30, science in the Bible. There's so many examples. I can only do a couple. Maybe you could give a couple. But every word the Bible describes the natural world, it gets it right. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. For millennia, we thought that the universe was eternal. We now know from Big Bang cosmology that it had a beginning. Gee whiz, Genesis was saying that for 2,500 years. Genesis also got the order of creation right. There's a verse in Isaiah where it talks about being above the earth and seeing the orb of the earth, that it's round. Are there any that you want to add? Or?
Well, I think if you go, I believe it's in Job, it talks very specifically about God creating and destroying creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is exactly consistent with what we see
in the fossil record.
Yeah.
This one is really deep, and I can only give a couple of examples. The remarkable understanding of the human condition from the Bible. Even now, most people would agree that if we could live by the standards we in the Bible, love, care for neighbor, community, human dignity, those kinds of things, which, by the way, are in the culture now because they're in the Bible. They didn't come in from thin air. That we would be happier and more fulfilled. But there's things like this balance between, you know, Tim Keller has this phrase. He says, I am I am more loved by God than I can ever imagine, and I am a bigger sinner than I want to admit. And if you want to solve a lot of your neuroses and wonders about hope and purpose and destiny, just keep those two things in your head at the same time and think about them for a while. Because what it means is God absolutely loves me, even after all the crappy, stupid things I've done in my life. He still loves me. He would have died on the cross if I was the only human being that existed. So I now have my purpose. I am here because God created me. The other side of that becomes, I am a bigger sinner than I want to admit, which means I can't let that love that God has for me go to my head and say, gee, I can do anything I want. It keeps me perfectly balanced in the middle. I know what my purpose is. I can't get too far, too down on myself, and I can't let my head get too big. And after I have wrestled with that for a while, I feel like I'm really in a place of peace just from that dichotomy. To me, that's a really good example, one of many, where the Bible really understands human nature and how to flourish. Historical reliability of the Bible. There's no places in the Bible, there's no places, city places, or objects that the Bible describes that have ever been proved to not exist, or people, or events. And one by one, many places and many people that are in the Bible were slowly discovering that they were true. For many years, archaeologists says there was no city of Ur, where Abraham was from. And they used that to beat up the Bible. Well, now we found it. It's there. Gee, isn't that interesting? And one by one, we're discovering these places, and it gives you the impression that the Bible, is this really reliable document? Textual reliability of the Bible. Many New Testament scholars, even those not friendly, grant the reliability and recent writing of most of the books. We know the Old Testament has been in its current form for 2,200 years at least. So this is really important. Non-Christian scholars grant most of the New Testament as being authentic.
And that's important because the New Testament is what describes the miracles and the other things that Jesus did that lets us ask the question, did he rise from the dead?
Right. Yeah. And we're going to get to that one because it's big. Number 34, God promises in the Bible a redemption, a transformation, a spiritual transformation or change. And if we learn to follow him, we're going to learn to love. We're going to worship him. We're not going to worship the transient things in the world. And people outside the faith are going to see that change in us. And the Bible actually sees this as a big one. It says that we will see the love, that unbelievers will see us as different, and that's a big part of the reason that they would come to faith. We cannot discount this.
Individually and corporately.
That's right.
Because we love, the ancient Romans said that these people love each other in a way no other people love each other.
That's right.
Yeah.
Christian faith is not just rules to live by or a good philosophy. That's why it's so compelling. He promises that he will change us from the inside. And I know I need that personally. Answered prayer, number 35. As we learn to trust Christ, we learn to pray. As we pray, we see things happen that we know wouldn't have happened without it. And also we see changes in our own heart and outlook. If I pray for you, Mark, I have to take the time to do that. I have to humble myself before God. It's part of admitting that I can't make this happen by myself. And that's a process that helps me, as well as when I pray for you, it can actually have an effect on you. We cannot discount this example. Personal testimony. Many people who are hearing this or hear this kind of thing will say, I don't really understand a lot of these arguments, but what I have is a personal testimony of how I came to Christ and he changed me. I quit smoking. I quit drinking. I quit doing drugs. I have a sense of peace and purpose that I never had before. All of that can seem kind of squishy, but it is what God promises us. Now, maybe other religions can give us a little bit of this, but the other religions don't give us all the rest of this to go with it. And many people have come to Christ simply by the personal testimony of someone else without any of this other evidence. Resurrection of Jesus as an actual physical event. Look up Gary Habermas and his minimal facts hypothesis. There are a lot of scholars, Mark, who study Jesus who aren't believers. They just study Jesus as a historical figure, and they're doing history. They're historians. Many of them are actually antithetical to the faith. But Gary Habermas has this amazing argument that he makes. He uses these six facts, and he says these six facts are basically agreed on by every level of scholar. Christian, agnostic, and antagonistic to the faith. The six facts are Jesus was a real person. He died by crucifixion. Soon after he died, his followers had experiences of what they believed were actual appearances of the risen Jesus. They had their lives were transformed. That's the next fact. And many of them were martyred because of their belief. These facts, the facts about Jesus were taught very soon after his death. They weren't myths that built up over time. And James, the brother of Jesus, who was antagonistic to Jesus, and Paul both had experience with Christ. What you have to ask yourself is, what is the best explanation for those facts? And it's amazing how many scholars, how many people in history have started out to debunk Christianity by going to the resurrection and saying, I'm just going to show how there's some other explanation for that. And they wind up becoming followers of Christ because they can't debunk it. It's amazingly difficult. And anybody who doesn't believe it, go try it.
You're looking at one. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the last one. Wow, Mark, we're going to do it. 3 minutes. The gospel message itself. The idea that an almighty, eternal God of the universe who needs or lacks for nothing, would love his creatures so much that he would put his deity aside, become one of us with all the messiness and dirt and blood and hunger that that entailed, then willingly die a torturous death for our redemption is so audacious and subversive that I don't think a human being ever would have thought of that.
No, it is one of those accounts that is too incredible.
Yeah,
it's not like the myths. It doesn't make people better than they are. It's just amazing.
And you look at what the myths were at the time of Jesus. The gods were high in the heavens. They were unconcerned with humanity. They weren't perfect. They fought among themselves. This is an entirely strange way to think.
Yeah, there's a term for that. It's called sui generis. It means it's not like anything else. It's an own kind of class.
Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of our own kind of class, I think we've come to the end of this class.
You want to look at Q&A and try to take a couple?
Yeah. Before we do that, I just want to remind everyone that the purpose of this survey was to create what we call a cumulative argument. It's an argument from the weight of the evidence. You could look at any one of these 38 things that we've talked about, and you can say, well, I'm not so sure about that one, or I'm not so sure about this other one. But when you take them all together, it's a powerful, powerful set of arguments that are constellar. In other words, they're like a constellation. They all work together. You look at them, they start to make sense. And when you have this kind of constellation of arguments, and they're coherent, and they all point to the same thing, that's more powerful than anything that anybody else can come up with. So when you look at these arguments or hear those arguments, remember that if somebody doesn't like one of them, you've got 37 more.
That's right.
And there's a lot more than we put down here. We just tightened it up because we knew we were short on time.
Because we're hungry, and I want to get some.
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know.
And what, Mark, let me just say this. One of the things that really compels me is I want to encourage anyone to go through this list and look at what the atheist rebuttal is. And so many of them are, yeah, that's just the way it is, or it's just a coincidence, or we don't know. Is that really a robust defense of atheism compared to how strong the Christian arguments are?
Okay, well, we don't have any set of questions. So with that, it looks like the one question was, we weren't able to copy the web links. Is there some place to get them where one can cut and paste? I will try to get that for you next week. That looks like it comes from Craig McMahon. And was there a class last week? Yes, there was. It'll get posted if it hasn't been posted yet. And Doug McComb reminded me to please record. I put it on late. Doug, thank you for reminding me. And that's it. So we're done.
Wow, Mark, we did it.
We did. Thank you. I hope if you have any comments on this next time when the next week when Hugh Ross is in the Q&A time, just please let us know in the chat. We'd be interested in hearing your feedback from this.
We could come on at 10:30 and maybe respond to some questions.
Sure. And we'll go into the chat as well. So we'll look that way.
There's some chats.
Yeah, but we have to get off of this because we have another group coming in right behind us using the same platform.
Yeah, so thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening. I hope this added, strengthened your faith, gave you some ammunition for dealing with skeptics, and really gave you some interesting avenues to open up on your own.
Thank you very much, everybody. Have a good week.